Thank you, Alan. Now, even if some of those present at the Putin rally in Moscow yesterday had been told by their employers to go or given a day off, as a BBC team at the stadium heard, it was still a rapturous reception that he got. How should the West therefore read him, his motivations, his intention, his endgame in Ukraine? To do this, let's first look back with the help of the BBC's former Moscow correspondent, Kevin Connolly.
What's the biggest diplomatic lesson of the last 10 years if you're a Russian? Surely it is simply that you can't spell impunity without Putin. Think back to February 2014, when Russia's main crime at that point is against musical taste. This is the theme song of the Sochi Winter Olympics. Four days after Russia's drug-fueled assault on the medals table is over, Putin's army annexes the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. The timing appears utterly cynical, just designed to make sure that nothing spoiled the global headlines around Putin's closing ceremony. Western leaders are shocked. Here's David Cameron putting it into words.
It's a deeply serious situation, and we have to show real resolve, real resilience in demonstrating to Russia that if she carries on in this way, the relationship between Europe and Russia, Britain and Russia, America and Russia will be radically different in the future. They cannot go on in this way.
Now, Western sanctions do follow, although they don't really amount to much. And Putin even responds by blocking some Western food imports in return. The problem for Western leaders wasn't just to find the right words for that night's headlines. It was that the West had been undergoing a kind of mental and moral disarmament for years, even as Putin consolidated his grip on power in the Kremlin. Here's Barack Obama, for example, mocking rival presidential candidate Mitt Romney for daring to suggest that Russia was any kind of threat or rival in a debate a few years earlier.
A few months ago, when you were asked what's the biggest geopolitical threat facing America, you said Russia. In the 1980s, are now calling to ask for their foreign policy back because, you know, the Cold War has been over for 20 years.
Отличить истинных патриотов. От подонков и предателей. И просто выплюнет их, как случайно залетевшую в рот мошку, выплюнет на панель.
Putin's tone this week may feel a little hysterical, but his analysis of the West has a kind of brutal logic to it. The West was desperate to move on from the Cold War, having won it at great expense. So Putin was left to calculate that if he ever did anything to shock world opinion, Western reaction would always been dominated by the fear that he'd do something worse if he was punished. Think of the 4 years between those Sochi Winter Olympics and the Moscow World Cup final in 2018. Years that included the annexation of Crimea, the puppet uprisings in the Donbass, the assassination of the opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, and the attempted murder of the Skripals using a nerve agent on the streets of the UK. The decade-long legal persecution of Alexei Navalny rumbles along in the background.
Germany are champions of the world!
Then think of that global celebration of sport in Moscow, with a grinning Putin centre stage, and beside him FIFA president Gianni Infantino.
You welcome the world as friends. The world has created bonds of friendship with Russia that will last forever.
This time around, Vladimir Putin has clearly been surprised and enraged by the range of the West's financial and economic sanctions. He has finally hit a red line, perhaps. But it's not quite the first sanction that hit home in Moscow.
Day and night, and all I do is dreaming. Faces he can stare on the ceiling.
This is the sound of Yulia Samoylova, who was barred from representing Russia in Kiev when Ukraine hosted Eurovision in 2017. It was because she'd previously performed in occupied Crimea. Russia was furious, pulled out of the competition and called the Ukrainian decision inhumane. Inhumane. A word I found myself looking for rather a lot just lately.
That's Kevin Connolly, our former Moscow correspondent. And listening to that is Jonathan Powell, who was chief of staff to Tony Blair when he met Vladimir Putin first back in 1999. And also Sasha Havlicek, chief executive of the security think tank, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, which focuses on disinformation and extremism. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Could we
Morning.
Look back on mistakes or lessons from how Putin was handled, as well as looking forward? Jonathan Powell, first of all, as you look back now to those meetings between Blair and Putin, how do you reflect on them?
Well, in 1999, when Tony Blair went and met Putin in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, while he was actually running for president, and was the first Western leader to meet him, he seemed a great contrast to Yeltsin. Yeltsin had been enormously brave, but he was this very, very odd figure who was quite often drunk and quite often eccentric in his policy decisions. Here seemed someone more bureaucratic, more inclined to reform, rather unassuming, small. It seemed like a chance to reach out to Russia, and that's what we tried to do. And up to 2001, certainly, that was working. He rang up on the day of 9/11, offering intelligence assistance, basing. He couldn't get hold of George Bush on that day, and he offered these things to Tony Blair. So he seemed like someone who's moving Russia in the right direction. But each time we met him after that, he seemed more and more full of hubris. He had more servants, more horses, more appliances in his dacha. And I think that hubris is what's put paid to him. And when Tony Blair met him the last time in 2007, he had a very difficult conversation with him. He decided he wanted to tell him what he thought about Litvinenko and the autocracy. And it was just Tony Blair and Putin, a Russian translator, and me. And Tony really told him what he thought. And Putin came back saying, "You don't care about us killing dissidents on your streets." We were really shocked by what he said and gave it back with two barrels. So this was someone who changed as a result of being in office. And if you're in office in an autocracy, that's what happens.
So, Sasha Havlicek, I wonder if you think Putin changed or whether he was misread by leaders like Tony Blair and others.
I think that perhaps people misunderstood his desire to make Russia great again from the outset. And I think Kevin Connolly's piece is really interesting. He, you know, clearly variously and repeatedly tested Western resolve. What he didn't include in his report was, of course, the invasion of Georgia already back in 2008, the perpetration of war crimes in Syria, which people don't talk about enough. He's sending mercenaries into Libya and the Sahel. And of course, then the cyber and information warfare that Russia has waged, not only in its neighborhood, but of course, across Western populations, which we became really conscious of only after 2016, a sort of penny dropped. And he has been testing to see how far he could go over and over again. And this is part of a long-term strategy, which is essentially to undo the post-Cold War liberal order, to reestablish Russia's greatness, and to do that essentially by destabilizing the liberal democracies that underpin that world order. And I think we have to be clear, you know, this is about undermining the values that won out at the end of the Cold War, democracy over authoritarianism and so on. And so if we fail this time, we are going to be facing really an existential threat.
So then to the looking forward, Jonathan Powell, you are part of what you do now is as a professional negotiator, isn't it? I wonder if you did have the task of, and I know this is unlikely, but President Zelensky is talking for face-to-face talks with President Putin now. If you were in that room, what would you do? How would you try and bridge the gap?
Well, the problem with the peace talks, of course, is that Putin is approaching these completely cynically. He's using them as a way of playing for time, of trying to divide the Ukrainian side by making it look like they're making concessions to him. So I think Zelensky's absolutely right to keep open the possibility of talking. We need a way out for Putin in these circumstances, otherwise he'll just escalate at every opportunity. But I don't think he's ready to talk yet. Zelensky's been asking for a face-to-face meeting for a long time, before the war even started. And Putin, of course, isn't going to agree. He might agree in the end when he is ready to concede, if he ever is ready to concede. He may just want to go down. But if he doesn't, then there will have to be negotiations. And again, Zelensky's right about this. And there are some aspects that you could talk about. What they cannot do is reward Putin for his aggression. As Sasha says, we have to be clear about our red lines. We weren't in Syria. We weren't in Georgia. and we weren't in 2014. And this time we have to be very, very clear that he cannot profit from his aggression.
But this is exactly another test, isn't it, of in a process like that, Sasha Havlicek, what do you put on one side in order to give Ukraine peace again?
I think there's four things we need to do really, very concertedly now. There is more that can be done on the sanctions front. You know, we actually need to completely deplete Putin of his means to wage this war. And we need to do that extremely fast. So there's more there.
What do you mean? Can I just ask you just specifically what is there that hasn't
been
done?
Well, for instance, I mean, I think 70-odd% of the banks, for instance, in Russia have been ousted from the SWIFT system. We need 100% ousted, and that will really hurt very seriously the Russian economy. We need we simply need more complete sanctions in place so that he no longer has the wherewithal to pay for this war, which is extremely costly. We also really need to boost our military assistance. And we've seen some wavering lately. And I think that both in terms of the practicalities of getting the arms that they need into their hands, but also in terms of the messaging from the West that we are standing firm, it's going to be extremely important that we move forward. But there's two other things that people don't talk about. One is the fact that there is more that we can be doing on the information side, on the information war front, in terms of shutting down Putin's ability to wage that side of the warfare, because his ground game is always accompanied by the information war. And finally, on the humanitarian front, we keep talking about NATO and the fact that we can't intervene because Ukraine isn't a NATO member. But what of the responsibility to protect, after all? We have heard now Biden talk about this as being war crimes. We have this doctrine, which was signed up to by all UN members in 2005, to prevent genocide, war crimes, make it an imperative to intervene in these contexts.
Sasha Havlicek.
What about?
Understood. Thank you very much, Sasha Havlicek and Jonathan Powell.
The time now is 12 minutes to 9. After a